Well, now, as we've been hearing in the news headlines, the UK Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab has resigned, piling more pressure on Prime Minister Theresa May. And to that can be added the resignation of the Work and Pension Secretary Esther McVeigh in the last few minutes. There has been widespread anger, as we know, within the Democratic Unionist Party and also within different wings of the Conservative Party since the deal reached between the UK and the EU on the withdrawal agreement became public. Mrs May is due to address Parliament at Westminster in the next half hour or so, and will also face tough questions from opposition MPs and perhaps some of her own as well, fellow Conservatives, over the course of the morning. For the latest now, in London, the breaking story, I'm joined by Quentin Letts on the line. Quentin, bring us up to date. Two high-profile resignations. Is there a surprise at these moves?
Not really. I mean, it is there is an element of surprise in that it's always unexpected when a cabinet minister does something honourable. But that's a very jaundiced view, I know. But I don't think you can really claim to be surprised, given that accounts of the cabinet meeting yesterday, it sounds as though Esther McVeigh was treated rather severely. So she's one of the people who's gone today. And Dominic Raab has gone because I think his views were being ignored. And there's no point serving in a cabinet unless your views are being listened to. And really what Theresa May has been doing is that she's been ignoring her cabinet, and she's been placing officials, i.e. civil servants, over the head of political appointees, and that is never a great idea.
Well, I wonder how fair is that, and you talk about it an honourable thing if people are surprised if people do the honourable thing, but, I mean, just looking at what happened in the case of Mr Raab, I mean, how do you lead the UK's negotiating team to the conclusion of agreement with the EU? You then sit through a five-hour cabinet meeting which collectively agrees to support the deal that you steer to its conclusion, and then you get up the next morning and you resign at 9 o'clock.
Well, I mean, perhaps he should have walked out of the thing yesterday afternoon, a bit like Michael Heseltine. I don't know if that would have been more honourable or less honourable. People might have said that he was playing to the gallery. So, I mean, that's a 50-50 ball, I think. But as far as the more important question of how could he have been part of this deal-making process and now suddenly quit at the end, I think it's because he was probably saying to Mrs. May all along, you're not going to get this through the cabinet. I can't see how we can ever sell this. She was saying, no, I've got to be able to do this. And when the cabinet decided it was going to take collective responsibility for it, Mr. Raab felt he couldn't be part of that collective.
And Esther McVeigh, the Work and Pension Secretary, you say she was not well treated at cabinet yesterday, but what she was pushing for was a free vote among cabinet ministers. Now, that would be a rare thing.
No, I don't think so. No, she was asking for a vote to be taken inside the cabinet rather than just a collecting of voices. It's a nice distinction, I think. But you can't have the cabinet secretary, who is a civil servant, shouting at a cabinet minister, and that's what happened yesterday to her. Sure. And the important symbolism there is that the politicians are representatives of the people, so to speak. They are the elected people in the room, and the officials are just career civil servants. And I think the whole Brexit process, the whole Brexit revolution, if you like, has been an expression of public, of the voters' displeasure at the way that officialdom has run things for the last 40 years.
And can you see her surviving then? I mean, how do you think she's going to be undone then?
I think there's undoubtedly going to be a vote of confidence in her now among Tory MPs. She might well win that. But if you remember, Mrs. Thatcher won the first ballot of her leadership election 28 Novembers ago. It was almost this week, wasn't it? And even though she won the first ballot, she was a goner. And I just don't see that Mrs. May can survive, because, I mean, there's no way that she can get this deal through Parliament.
And what about Dominic Raab? Is his resignation, it's the first one out of the cabinet, is he's somebody obviously who is known to have higher ambition. He would want to succeed Mrs. May. Is that fair to say?
I don't know if he does. I guess so. I mean, we journos always think that all politicians are ambitious so-and-sos, and that's probably it's a fair guess, I'd say, but I don't know whether he would be acceptable to... I don't know whether he's got quite the sort of the presentational juice about him to appeal to the public, and if it to the Tory membership, and if it if Boris Johnson can get in to the mix, I think he would undoubtedly be the choice of the Tory members if he can get past the hurdle of being chosen as one of the two candidates.
Right. Stay with us if you can, Quentin. I want to go to Jim Wells, a DUP MLA for South Down. Good morning to you, Jim Wells.
Good morning, Sean.
This is a bit like history repeating itself. I just happen to remember, I looked at the date this morning. This is the 15th of November. It's 33 years to the day from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. I know where I was. I think you were there as well, Hillsborough, on that day. And you and your party were Hillsborough, the Anglo-Irish Agreement at Hillsborough.
Anglo-Irish, Sean, not the Belfast Agreement.
I beg your pardon, the Hillsborough Agreement, the Anglo-Irish Agreement, a momentous occasion. You and Dr. Paisley and many more were outside the gates, but you were ignored, as you were ignored when the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998. And it looks like your views are being ignored again. Your bluff is being called by Mrs. May.
Well, we were right in both occasions, and I suspect we're right again. This time it's much more difficult to ignore the DUP because we hold the balance of power at Westminster. And what's absolutely clear, Sean, is this deal is dead. And my prediction is that Theresa May will not be the Prime Minister of the UK by Christmas. All the evidence, Robert Peston was on last night on BBC here locally saying that the 48 names to prompt a leadership contest are now inevitable. There's huge concern. There will be further resignations. I'd be very surprised if Andrea Leadsom, the Leader of the House, is still in the Cabinet by this time tomorrow. It's quite clear that this is unravelling. This was an impossible deal. And I'm heartened by the fact that many, many Conservative MPs, their main reason why they're against this is that it undermines the constitutional status of Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom, that they see any change in their status through Brexit as very dangerous to the Union. And I'm heartened by that. And really, this deal is going absolutely nowhere.
But there is a specific provision guaranteeing, as was done in Hillsborough, as was done in the Belfast Agreement, and is now there again, there will be no change in the constitutional status of Northern Ireland without the agreement of a majority of the people. I mean, what more do you need to hear?
Because, yes, we get these assurances, and meanwhile, everything's being done to undermine that status within the United Kingdom. Let's be honest about it. There can be no provision for Northern Ireland to leave the European Union on any other basis but the rest of the UK. We cannot have a border down the Irish Sea. The total trade with the Irish Republic from the United Kingdom is 0.2% of our GDP. It's tiny.
Yes,
we cannot endanger our constitutional status for that amount of trade.
But look at the other side of it. There is a golden opportunity here for Northern Ireland to have unfettered access to the entire single market in the European Union. Great opportunities to trade, great opportunities to do business, great opportunities to attract inward investment. Are you going to spurn those?
Because the problem is 75% of our trade is not with the EU, it's with the rest of the United Kingdom. And the problem
is... And that will remain as well.
Yes, but hampered by European regulations, which we will have to enforce, but we'll have no say at the table in how we actually develop those regulations. And let's be clear about this. One of the reasons why the Irish Republic is so against us leaving the European Union on the same basis as the rest of the UK is that it makes more difficult to harmonise the two parts of the island politically. There is a hidden agenda here, but by far and away the most dangerous aspect of this is it puts a regulatory border, down the middle of the Irish Sea. You would never tolerate it down the middle of the Shannon, and we're certainly not going to tolerate it down the middle of the Irish Sea.
So you don't see any upside to this. I mean, like, as we said before, there are differences between the regulations in Northern Ireland and mainland UK, to use that phrase, where animal health is concerned and so forth. And it's not so long ago since I think the Assembly, when it was up and running, and the Executive was looking to Gordon Brown back in the day to get the same corporation tax arrangement for Northern Ireland as applied in the Republic, 12.5%. What would have been wrong with that? Would that have diminished the union?
Let's not say it's the rest of the UK. It is the rest of the UK. We are British. We're not Irish. Secondly, those are decisions that our Parliament or our Assembly could make. But what we're being asked to deal with in the future are decisions which we have no say in. Regulations passed by Brussels and Strasbourg, we'd have lost our European Members of Parliament. We'd have lost our commissioners. So we'd have no input whatsoever about these decisions, but they will be enforced upon us. And that is a major constitutional problem for the UK.
Would you prefer then there to be no arrangement for Britain to crash out of the European Union in March as opposed to taking this deal?
Nobody wants a hard border. No one wants to send the markets into chaos. Everyone wants to maintain the excellent relationships we now enjoy with the Irish Republic. We want to maintain that. So the hard border, hard Brexit is something that nobody wants. We're going to have to go back to the drawing board and come up with probably what we call a Canada Plus Two agreement, whereby we maintain good relationships with all of the EU, including the Irish Republic. But the major constitutional Rubicon, which are being asked to cross today, is not on, and our 10 MPs, and I could say at least 80 other MPs, will be voting against it. This deal is dead, and I don't know why Theresa May continues to flog the
proverbial
dead horse.
And you say she's going to be no longer Prime Minister by Christmas. That's what you said at the outset.
That would be my prediction. The 48 names, I understand, Robert Peston is very well respected in political circles in the United Kingdom. Robert Peston is saying 48 names are in. I believe he's right, and I'd be surprised if other cabinet ministers, such as Andrea Leadsom, are still in position in 24 hours' time.
Jim Wells, thank you. And to come to you, Liam Halligan, a columnist with the Sunday Telegraph. We've spoken to you many times in this programme before. You've always put up a strong case for Brexit, but not this Brexit.
Morning, Sean. Well, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, to lose one Brexit secretary is misfortune. To lose two is surely carelessness. And I think Theresa May here is in a real hole of her own making. This deal is dead. Your previous speaker is correct. My old friend Robert Peston, in my view, is also correct. The 48 names are in, which will trigger a vote of no confidence. But we must distinguish between names that are in and names that have been activated. Some MPs I've spoken to, Conservatives, have submitted their letters, but on agreement with Graham Brady, who's the chairman of the backbench Tory committee, the so-called 22 committee, when they phone him or send him a simple text message, then their letters are activated. We shall see. I agree with Quentin Letts. I do think there'll be a vote of no confidence. And I think when future historians look back on this, May will be seen as somebody who told the cabinet, who told her government, who told the Commons, who told the British public, who told the world that one negotiation was going on, the negotiation that began with her Lancaster House speech, where she said Britain was leaving the single market and the customs union, subsequent speeches, Fontainebleau, Mansion House and so on. But actually, none of that negotiation was really happening. The whole thing was a facade, because another secret negotiation was going on between Number 10, the coterie of advisers who surrounded her and misadvised her, in my view, and the Commission. That was the negotiation which led to the so-called Chequers Agreement, which was a disaster, and this deal, which is also a disaster. And she's managed to unite, Sean, she's managed to unite people who are entirely opposed, symbolised by the two Johnson brothers, who are entirely opposed, agreeing with each other.
Yeah, but one of those Johnson brothers...
And parties right across the Commons. That's why this deal simply won't happen, and I don't think she'll be Prime Minister in the near future.
One of the Johnson brothers was Boris, the better known, and he was the one who said Britain could have its cake and eat it, remain in a position where it had full access to the European markets and then do its own trade deals with the rest of the world. And that was a fallacy from the off, and everybody knew it.
Well, look, let's be completely clear. You don't need to be in the European Union to trade with... You don't need to be in a single market to trade with the European Union. The United States did over $350 billion worth of trade with the European Union last year, and it wasn't in the single market last time I looked. Same with China and many other of the large economies of the East. You don't need to be in the single market, paying big money every year, allowing freedom of movement, allowing the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice in order to trade with the European Union. And I've always said, and I explained very, very carefully in my book Clean Brexit with fellow Irish-English person Gerry Lyons, that we could trade outside the single market freely with the European Union. Yeah, there may be a few tariffs here and there, but that's why you do a trade deal. What we've got here isn't a prototype trade deal. It's complete subjugation, I'm afraid, and a lot of the British public know that. That's why there isn't actually support for a so-called people's vote, even though we had a people's vote in June 2016. There are lots of people inside the Westminster bubble backed up with an awful lot of money from big business promoting the so-called people's vote. But outside the M25, Sean, where I live, in the shires of England in the old industrial, post-industrial towns. There's no demand at all for a people's vote. There's just demand for people, the political class and the media class, to get on with this.
They might have
and
a different
to leave
idea.
The European Union.
They might have a different idea if Joe Johnson's fear that the traffic will be backed all the way up from Dover to the M25. But in any event, look, I say thanks to you and good morning, Liam Halligan. I want to go back briefly to Quentin Lutz before I bring in our own Finance Minister, Pascal Donohue, Finance and Public Expenditure and Reform Minister. Quentin, what do you see as the sequence of events now? Do you think that Mrs. May will be gone before there's a chance for the Commons to vote on this?
Yes, I think that's very possible. I mean, I can't really. It's extremely difficult to predict, but I suspect that what might happen, there may be a vote of confidence in her. She might win that, but win it insufficiently.
Yes.
And then I think she would announce that she was going.
I don't agree with what you just said, and it's actually factually wrong.
Yeah, another one bites the dust, by the way. I just see on Sky, a junior minister, Brexit minister, Suella Braverman, resigns. But look, my thanks to you both for joining us from London. Quentin Lutz of the Daily Mail and also Liam Halligan, columnist with the Telegraph, Minister for Finance, Public Expenditure and Reform, Pascal Donohue. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
We're going to carry Theresa May's statement live at 10:30. But between now and then, you might just in part explain, how can this deal, it might be a great deal from the Irish government's point of view, how is it ever going to see the light of day in regard to implementation, given the chaos that's going on?
Well, amidst the volatility that's taking place in Irish, in British politics, it's imperative that the approach that we have used to date, that has got us to this point, is continued. We have three priorities as this unfolds. Number one, an agreement was made with the British Cabinet and the European Commission last night that is supported by key European leaders. Number two, we have to continue with all our preparatory work for different Brexit scenarios that could unfold. And number three, we have to continue to be careful with our economy to ensure that we are resilient for the different things we might face in the future. But this was an agreement that was made last night. It respects the national priorities that the Taoiseach has outlined now over the last period. And we will continue to work within the European Union to deliver our goals.
Yeah, I see Theresa May's car just sweeping out of Downing Street as you speak on the way to the Commons. We'll be coming to that in a few minutes. But does this mean that the febrile atmosphere now in Britain, that you are going to have to put increasing emphasis, not in implementing this deal, but in preparing a plan B?
We're very clear. There is a debate underway in British politics, but our expectation is the same as Prime Minister May, that an agreement be passed, which is this agreement, that delivers against the priorities of ensuring we don't have a hard border on our island, and creates the best platform for a future agreement with the UK and the EU. And to directly answer your question, since the very start of this, we have been preparing and reviewing for all eventualities. So this is why, over the last number of weeks, the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste have hosted four different Brexit seminars with Irish stakeholders to ensure our preparedness is as advanced as possible.
OK, so what are the broad strokes then? If, you know, a raglan a hagla, there is a no-deal Brexit and it is the crashing out that happens. What are the broad strokes of those preparations? What are you saying to Irish business?
Well, what we are continuing to do is, firstly, look at where we need to be with our economy overall to make sure that it is in a strong position. As we move into next year, we will have books that are broadly balanced, that are indeed fully balanced, which is the strongest place to be. And in terms of what we are doing and how we're engaging with Irish business, it has always been to get ready for the kind of arrangements that will develop when the United Kingdom becomes a third country. But I want to reiterate, while you were hearing the kind of divergence of view in British politics at the moment, the Irish government, the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste are crystal clear. We made an agreement last night where the European Union, through the Commission, has a draft protocol now with the United Kingdom that both bodies indicated support for, and this is an agreement that offers the best platform for moving forward.
But as any experienced or even not inexperienced negotiator will tell you, the worst kind of a deal to make is one with another party who can't deliver what they sign up to.
I think it's very early in the day to be making such an assessment. We have seen throughout this entire process Prime Minister May find a way of moving the process forward, and I think think what is going to be increasingly obvious as we move through this phase of the debate is many other scenarios that will have to be contemplated for the British economy, for what this could mean for the UK, pose very, very grave challenges. Now, with respect, it's the job of the British government to deal with that. But of course, those leading the negotiation have reached this point for the British government because they're conscious of what other alternatives could be.
But it's not just people like Boris Johnson who are recoiling in horror, genuine or otherwise, from this deal, but it's people like Tony Blair, former Prime Minister. He's been out in the last 24 hours on several TV channels saying, look, this is Brexit in name, but we are still tied to Europe in reality. A bad deal. How do you dissuade him of that view?
Well, it's the job of Prime Minister May, actually, to put views forward to our own people, in fairness, Sean. But I imagine the case that will be made is that if British business, if British trade unions, if British workers have the objective of trying to maintain as close to frictionless trade as possible and have the objective of wanting to continue the integration of their own supply chains, in other words, how they move goods around with that of the European Union, a shared customs space is needed. And this comes back to the core point. If you are making things, or if you need things to keep your economy stable and growing, how they're moved in and out of your territory is crucial.
Yeah, but we heard, for instance, people talk about it. Jim Wells mentioned it, and he's not the first or the only one, Canada plus two type agreement as being the better alternative from the Brexiteers' point of view. What is the problem there?
That options like that don't deal with the key needs that we have in terms of ensuring that we have options in place for preventing a hard border on our island. And I'd just like to address a point that was made earlier on, the idea in relation to the objectives of this government. The only objective that we have in terms of our island is to ensure the stability and recognition of the Good Friday Agreement and to have an architecture in place to avoid the prevention of a hard border on our island. And surely, as we're looking at the debate that's underway and the different views that have been articulated, it just reaffirms the need for a backstop.
Yes, but if you listen to Mrs May, and I no doubt you did last night on the steps of number 10, where she said about talked about the detailed and impassioned debate on the graft withdrawal agreement. She said the choices before us were difficult, particularly in relation to the Northern Ireland backstop, but the collective decision of Cabinet was that the government should agree the draft withdrawal agreement and the outline political declaration. Did the Irish government and by extension the European negotiators led by Monsieur Barnier, did you push the British too hard perhaps?
We have an objective which we've outlined in terms of what we need to secure in our island. And the very fact that the British government, that Prime Minister May and her team were willing to agree to this draft protocol last night shows the weight of the claim that we have and the recognition of it by the British government. Sean, we're in the realm now of where there are no easy choices. We're now in the phase of all this where the purity of a simple claim meets the sophistication and nuance of the Good Friday Agreement and the reality of integrated economies. And the British government, and in fairness to Prime Minister May, have understood this. And surely it's the job of the Irish government to look at putting in place agreements that offer the best protection to us and the ability of mitigating many difficult consequences that could lie ahead.
But it's not just people being Pavlovian, say, and that charge might be made. I'm not saying you're making it about the DUP. I mean, they're saying now what they said 33 years ago. No. But I mean, look at Dominic Raab, what he said in his letter. And I know you say it's for the British Prime Minister to persuade her people. But he says, first of all, the two reasons he puts forward for not supporting the deal. First, he says the regulatory regime for Northern Ireland poses a very real threat to the integrity of the UK.
And the early protocols, the early sections of the protocol make clear that there is nothing in this agreement that looks to infringe the territorial integrity of the United Kingdom or undermine the Good Friday Agreement.
But that's what you're saying. But again, it's sort of, look also at what is being done as well as what is being said.
Sean, it's not just what I'm saying. It's what is in a text that was agreed by the British Cabinet.
And he also says, Mr. Raab, the EU veto over the backstop regime, a hybrid of the customs union and single market obligations with an EU veto over our ability to exit. I mean, like Sammy Wilson of the DUP brings down that down to a very simple two-word description, a punishment beating for Britain.
And this recognises the fact that in the event of the UK looking to fundamentally change its relationship with the European Union, there are shared consequences of that happening. And in those shared consequences, the Irish state is in the front line of that. And surely, again, in the face of that, it is reasonable for the European Union and for the Irish government through the European Union to be recognised that if there are shared, exceptionally serious consequences in relation to this, there should be a shared decision-making process.
So what's in this? I mean, what is in this deal for Britain then?
What this is for the British government, and again, I'm sure Prime Minister May will be making this case, is it offers the best platform within which British jobs and British trade will be able to continue and be able to continue to grow. And it offers an environment in which we have and they have the best possibility for low friction trade in the future. And they have avoided the potential for a hard border in our island and the potential for a customs line in between Ireland and the United Kingdom. And these are all objectives that the British government have articulated.
We may have to go live to Westminster in the middle of my asking this next question, or indeed your answering it,
Minister. Let's see what the question is, Sean.
But it's based on a piece in the Financial Times on page 3 about the customs union. And the headline says, backstop flaws ensure, quote, it could never be used, unquote. And it basically says that on the one hand, Brexiters are furious the backstop could lull Britain into a never-ending state of affairs in which the UK maintains market access to Europe but loses control over trade or economic policy. On the other hand, some Europeans are nervous because they fear Britain would have one foot in Europe's market enjoying tariff-free access while undercutting the business standards of... Sorry, Theresa May speaking.
...Borton and Tatton. Delivering Brexit involves difficult choices for all of us. We do not agree on all of those choices, but I respect their views and I would like to thank them sincerely for all that they have done. Mr. Speaker, yesterday we agreed the provisional terms of our exit from the European Union, set out in the draft withdrawal agreement. We also agreed the broad terms of our future relationship in an outline political declaration. President Juncker has now written to the President of the European Council to recommend that decisive progress has been made in the negotiations, and a special European Council will be called for Sunday the 25th of November. This puts us close to a Brexit deal. Mr. Speaker, what we agreed yesterday was not the final deal. It is a draft treaty. It is a draft treaty that means that we will leave the EU in a smooth and orderly way on the 29th of March 2019. And which sets the framework for a future relationship that delivers in our national interest. It takes back control of our borders, laws and money. It protects jobs, security and the integrity of the United Kingdom. And it delivers in ways that many said could simply not be done. We were told that we had a binary choice between the model of Norway or the model of Canada, that we could not have a bespoke deal. But the outline political declaration sets out an arrangement that is better for our country than both of these, a more ambitious free trade agreement than the EU has with any other country. And we were told we would be treated like any other third country on security cooperation. But the outline political declaration sets out a breadth and depth of cooperation beyond anything the EU has agreed with any other country. So let me take the House through the details. First, on the withdrawal agreement, the full legal text has now been agreed in principle. It sets out the terms on which the UK will leave the EU in 134 days' time on the 29th of March 2019. We have secured the rights of the more than 3 million EU citizens living in the UK and around 1 million UK nationals living in the EU. We have agreed a time-limited implementation period that ensures businesses only have to plan for one set of changes. We have agreed protocols to ensure Gibraltar and the sovereign base areas are covered by the withdrawal agreement. And we have agreed a fair financial settlement far lower than the figures many mentioned at the start of this process. Mr. Speaker, since the start of this process, I have been committed to ensuring that our exit from the EU deals with the issue of the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. I believe this issue can best be solved through our future relationship with the European Union. But the withdrawal agreement sets out an insurance policy should that new relationship not be ready in time at the end of the implementation period. I do not pretend that this has been a comfortable process, or that either we or the EU are entirely happy with all of the arrangements that have been included within it. But of course this is the case. This is an arrangement that we have both said we never want to have to use. But while some people might pretend otherwise, there is no deal which delivers the Brexit the British people voted for, which does not involve this insurance policy. Not Canada plus plus plus, not Norway for now, not our own white paper. The EU will not negotiate any future partnership without it. As the House knows, the original proposal from the EU was not acceptable, as it would have meant creating a customs border down the Irish Sea and breaking up the integrity of our United Kingdom. So last month I set out for the House the four steps we needed to take. This is what we have now done, and it has seen the EU make a number of concessions towards our position. First, the EU proposal for a Northern Ireland-only customs solution has been dropped and replaced by a new UK-wide temporary customs arrangement that protects the integrity of our precious union. Second, we have created an option for a single time-limited extension of the implementation period as an alternative to bringing in the backstop. As I have said many times, I do not want to extend the implementation period, and I do not believe we will need to do so. This is about an insurance policy. But if it happens that at the end of 2020, our future relationship is not quite ready, the UK will be able to make a choice between the UK-wide temporary customs arrangement or a short extension of the implementation period. Third, the withdrawal agreement commits both parties to use best endeavours to ensure this insurance policy is never used. And in the unlikely event that it is needed, if we choose the backstop, the withdrawal agreement is explicit that it is temporary and that the Article 50 legal base cannot provide for a permanent relationship. And there is also a mechanism by which the backstop can be terminated. Finally, we have ensured full continued access for Northern Ireland's businesses to the whole of the UK internal market. Mr. Speaker, the Brexit talks are about acting in the national interest. And that means making what I believe to be the right choices, not the easy ones. I know there are some who have said I should simply rip up the UK's commitment to a backstop, but this would have been an entirely irresponsible course of action. It would have meant reneging on a promise made to the people of Northern Ireland during the referendum campaign and afterwards that under no circumstances would Brexit lead to a return to the borders of the past. And it would have made it impossible to deliver a withdrawal agreement. As Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, I have a responsibility to people in every part of our country, and I intend to honour that promise. Mr. Speaker, by resolving this issue, we are now able to move on to finalising the details of an ambitious future partnership. The outline political declaration we have agreed sets out the basis for these negotiations, and we will negotiate intensively ahead of the European Council to turn this into a full future framework. The declaration will end free movement once and for all. Instead, we will have our own new skills-based immigration system, based not on the country people come from, but on what they can contribute to the UK. The declaration agrees the creation of a free trade area for goods with zero tariffs, no fees, charges or quantitative restrictions across all goods sectors. No other major advanced economy has such an arrangement with the EU, and at the same time we will also be free to strike new trade deals with other partners around the world.
And there we leave that statement in the Commons by the Prime Minister, Theresa May, saying she doesn't want to extend the implementation period, that it is a good deal that keeps the British government, keeps the promise that there will be no hard border in Northern Ireland and ensures that Northern Ireland has access to free trade with the rest of Europe. We'll continue with this analysis a little after 11. Right now, though, we take a break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.